Welcome to the Ender Seeking Podcast. This week we're on episode 13 and you're here with myself, Imogen, and Martin. It's funny because we were, it was 2019 when we...
Was it 19?
Yeah, I think it was 2019 when we did the first episode, and then obviously that didn't continue.
Because it wasn't even planned as an episode, was it? It was just, you had surreptitiously. We were having a one of our conversations in the garden of a house set, and you sneakily put the phone on to record it.
Yeah, but we talked about doing a podcast.
We had, yeah.
We just hadn't agreed to record a podcast, but That's the surreptitious bit. Yeah, we were talking about it. And so, it's been a long time. I mean, you've been interested in podcasts before they were even a thing. Much of a thing.
I remember way back, we were working in the UK back in, what year was it? It was 2004, 2005, yep. Just before we went to live in America. And I was locked in an R&D lab doing tests on, filters and all this stuff. It was all very, very isolated. And I thought, I need something to occupy my time while I'm waiting for these tests and whatnot. And I got my first iPod, which was this super cute little 4 or 6 gig black iPod Nano. And it's still my favorite to this day. And I loaded it up. But the podcasts that were going on back then that I was listening to was things like the Russell Brand podcast, because he had a radio show on Radio 2 in the UK. And it was hilarious, absolutely hilarious. And who else was it? I think Ricky Gervais was sort of doing one back then. Him and Carm Pilkington and Stephen Merchant were doing theirs. But it was like the very early days of audio. They weren't even actually completely called podcasts. Like it took a while actually for that term to really settle in, that it would, because they're on iPods, they're podcasts. But I remember that webcasts people used to say. And I mean, it's amazing how fast everything's gone actually. I mean, YouTube was still doing 10-minute clips back then, and it was just a different media world. But anyway, podcasts, I loved them. I thought I'd just plug in and listen to my podcasts. I can't believe all these years have passed. Where are we now? 2023. Jesus, almost like 20 years.
Time.
Oh, that's freaky. Anyway. But I wanted to make a podcast because I thought I could see it was the media of the future. Or the platform of the future, whatever you want to call it. It's definitely had something about it.
Yeah. There's something really beautiful about it, particularly in this day and age where you've got the likes of TikTok and it's all very immediate and everyone's attention span is sort of minuscule, like a gnat.
Yeah.
And there's something really beautiful about sort of these long form conversations where you can unpack things, and it's not so much about bite-sized pieces of information,
no,
but it is about sort of really getting into the depth of something, feeling of something,
giving the subject and the subject enough time to unpack,
some air to some room to breathe. And we've joked about this many, many times of, what do you call me? Amy Longform Weber.
It's true. Love it.
But there's two
modes. You don't deal in sound bites.
Not very easily,
there's the joke there.
Either silence or long form.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of perfect.
This is good. This is good for that. It gives you some time to unpack it.
Because here's the thing: is like, particularly in the sort of the subject that we're generally conversing in, which is obviously why we're doing this podcast.
Yeah.
It's like there's these two ways of experiencing it, and that one is that silence, as in, that which we're speaking of can't really be spoken of.
No. But it's found in silence, and in a sense is transmitted in silence as well. Yeah.
And then there's other stroke of it, which is because it can't be grasped too much in the mind, let's say. There's sort of this need for endless
qualification. An exposition and
I get people sometimes you get very pedantic on certain words or concepts and stuff like that, and then I've observed many times there comes a spot where in someone's sort of unfoldment where they get very, very het up on words,
right?
And we've spoken about this before in another episode, or touched on it at least. But it's this sort of, there comes a point where that becomes very important.
Yeah.
And it's not wrong at all. It is a stage. It is a sort of,
your discrimination and articulation has to be so like razor sharp and precise.
Yeah. Well, it's a recalibration of concepts and words that you thought meant something. And then now they're in light of an insight, to be recalibrated.
Well, it's before and after. These are almost two different things, right? Because if you're talking about beforehand, I remember the time of seeking where, you're in inquiry and you're really penning down to subtle.
Yeah.
And then after, as you said, what do we call it? Semantic what is that word?
Recalibration? No.
Semantic recalibration. We coined that. So I'm not sure which one you're talking about.
I'm talking about the recalibration. Yeah. So post awakening recalibration. But yeah, you've brought up an excellent point there. There comes a point prior to awakening where words, there is a sort of a dialing down into the minutiae. Yeah. Of, well, what is actually being pointed to here? And so everything gets very sort of focused in on the precision of words.
Yeah.
But, my view of that in the longer term of it all is words are inherently dualistic. They're never going to be able to point. And so, in many ways, it's okay to just be very light with words. And this is where the long form comes in. Qualify where needed.
Yeah. So I'll just pick up. I know you misspoke a little bit there. You said they're never going to be able to point. What you mean to say is that they're never going to be able to fully describe. Can point. That's the thing.
They
right?
can point. And I knew. Right. Yes,
So it's that.
See, this is it. This is a perfect case in point. If there is some words spoken and there's needing to be, clarification. This is where I think long form perfectly suits that, because clarification is always welcomed.
Indeed. Indeed.
And it's not about getting the words right then. It's about clarity and truth. This is what's most important to me, rather than the particulars of the words, is to do the words sufficiently clarify what is being pointed to. And in that way, you can start from a word that is, or a sentence or a concept that's very abstract and in many ways unhelpful or occluding. But if that starting point is only a jumping off point for clarity, it doesn't matter.
I remember the year after we both had our shift, and we were living back in the States, and we was just after a few months of just sort of staying with family, we started to house sit, do some house sits, sort of longer term, a month here or a couple of months there, we were still, I would say, basking in the newly recognized bliss of it all, in some senses. That's what my experience was. Anyway, I won't speak for you, but
it was not quite so clear cut for me, but yes, but there was certainly a lot of that.
But it was the start of something for me was tweeting. I started to sort of tweet. And back then, tweeting was still 140 characters. So you had to be really minimal zen about the whole thing. You really had to, you had a hard time getting your thoughts.
Talk about sound bites.
Talk about, well, that's it. And, but I remember the both of us, it was these expressions were emerging, just arising and emanating from within us. And I remember we would be up going, this makes sense, right? And we would be parsing our, you know, these very, very precise, let's say, pointings that were just emerging. Because for me, it was like, where do these come from? I never had the ability to articulate this in this way. And that's for me, that's a phenomenon as well. This capacity, this ability to sort of, you have it emerged for you, it emerged for me. The expression of this just wants to be spoken.
Well, right? We were talking about that the other day as something we should talk about on the podcast. Actually, we got here naturally, but of this thing of like not of that something came online in terms of the ability to speak.
The phenomena of speaking and that came through in speaking. So that's where you'll be in satsang or something. And then, you know, it's not like you go into a situation like satsang and, you know, have notes that you're going to refer to.
Oh my gosh, no.
I mean, we were talking about it now. In fact, the moment you've said it, typically someone says, what did you just say? I don't know.
Not,
you know,
a
it's
clue.
Gone. It's like a river.
Yeah. It's an emanation. It's like the, yeah, river flow of the infinite through this body, through this words and this mouth and this mind and all of that.
It's like the silence speaks, you know, it's like that. And
it's not me or mine. It's just, it's silence speaking. Yeah, that's a beautiful.
Well, I think someone, wasn't there a non-dual website at one point called Silence Speaks? Was it something like that? Anyway, but that's the truth of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, it's not what you speak, or I speak, or what I write, or you write, whatever. These aren't studied. I mean, no. I have, both have spent being exposed to teachings and traditions and whatnot, but actually it's not really about holding on or regurgitating or parroting teachings that have already gone before. I mean, quote once in a while, because it's nice to know that someone said what you've come to see before you have. It's like, oh, see, that Buddhist said that and that.
Actually, I would say, like, from my perspective of looking at you and the process you have gone through, I would say you were always very good at parroting, speaking the sort of the knowledge that you had learned.
Right.
And then, but there is a very clear and distinct difference to me now.
Yeah.
It's, and what I would, how I would characterize this, and you're not alone in that. I see it with people I work with as well.
It's a thing, yeah.
But I can use you as an example.
The mind can get hold of the words.
Yeah. Someone can be very, very, very well versed, far more than me. I'm fairly unstudied. I mean, I was exposed to it, but I was an awful student in terms of knowledge. Awful. So someone can come and you as an example in this case, very, very, very well studied, let's say, in all sorts of traditions, very well read. You know, someone can come in with that in their back pocket, let's say. But it's, the energy is very much coloring in the lines energy. It's like there's, can only go to certain ways in certain depths. And what I noticed with you after you went through that shift was It's like you can, there's no, you're no longer bound by the concepts
no.
of knowledge, as in you can pick up a thread from anywhere.
Well, it's interesting. Yes, exactly. It's interesting that this was one of, I thought we talked about this, but it's on the list anyway. And it was a quote from the Gita. Have we done this one? No. Great quote from the Gita that says, the Bhagavad Gita, that says, to the enlightened Brahmin, all of the Vedas are of as much use as a small well in a place flooded on every side. Did we?
Well, you and I have talked about that. Lord knows if we've talked about it on the podcast or not.
And it's
so.
One of my favorite verses because it really points to, I mean, in this case, the enlightened person. And the Vedas are, let's say, the scriptures. So to the enlightened person, all the scriptures are of as much use as a small well in a place flooded with water on every side. Yeah. It just shows how the difference between direct experience and self-realization and the restating or of scripture, of even if it's true.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's like absolutely.
Knowledge, scripture and stuff. That's the difference, and it's a really beautiful analogy, and it shows the magnitude of that difference, that although we use teachings, scriptures, you know, sutras, whatever, to get us, to point us back to our nature, once that nature has been discovered, rediscovered, the texts aren't useful for the most part. I mean, sure, I still reference various things
as reference points, that's fine. Yeah, I think there's a real different energy though to it. Speaking from their own direct knowingness, even referencing another, that still has an energy and a power to it.
Yeah,
an aliveness, a transmission, actually, which I would say.
Absolutely.
Versus the energy of knowledge has a tightness to it. That's my experience of it anyway, is there's a tightness there.
Well, it's just on a more superficial level. And there was a little video I made a couple of years ago. I didn't ever put it out. And it was in reference to the difference between, in some sense, this distinction between gaining knowledge and realization. And it was, it struck me, I was watching the movie Princess Bride, and there's a great scene in it where there's a fencing scene at the top of the hill between the man in black and Indigo Montoya, and as they're waiting to fight, the Spaniard was telling the man in black all about his history and what motivated him to become a great fencer. And the man in black says to him, oh, so all these years you've been studying fencing. And he went, more like pursuing. And I thought, wow, that distinction is really keen, actually. Because I, in my time seeking, wasn't really studying. I was pursuing. Mm-hmm. I was pursuing insight, pursuing spiritual insight through study. But it wasn't study for study's sake. Mm-hmm. It was like, what's resonating? What's true? And using that, you know, that pursuit. And so that's a real difference. Don't get caught up in this domain, study for study's sake, and know that the answers one seeks aren't intellectual. They're not. They don't exist. The answer doesn't come on that. It's an experiential answer. So if the answers you're getting are in the mind and from the mind, you're not there yet. You need to get beyond the mind.
And in that vein, I think it is, you know, a good moment to mention that you can come at this with endless viewpoints, endless ideas, endless pointers, or you can come at it with one single pointer.
Yeah.
And all pointers lead to the same recognition. Yeah. And so this is, you know, you see teachers and teachings that have got thousands of words.
Mm-hmm.
And they are still pointing to the same thing that those one set of words is said by another.
Well, that's why I was saying that the tweeting was so important, because I was forced, happily, to make really pointed expressions that were effective, I felt it, pointing back to what I was speaking about. And I loved that. I loved that, that they're like creating these aphorisms would emerge that were, and it just showed how little, as you're saying, how little it can actually take to point one back to the direct experience of self. It doesn't actually take, well, actually, at some point it takes nothing at all, because the recognition that you already are that is becomes abidingly present.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're still a seeker, sometimes, you know, you don't want an ocean of exposition. You want a short pointer. It's very zen. But at the same time, that time spent unpacking, unfolding, and becoming more, you know, awash in the reality and the expression of that reality verbally and experientially is really, really beautiful too. So it's all good.
Yeah. All pointers lead to the same.
Yeah.
Recognition.
Yeah.
Whether you are exposed to endless pointers.
Yeah.
Or the singular pointer.
I mean, it's funny. I see that people have different needs in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
And that can change in time as well.
Absolutely.
And for me, although I was very much on, let's say, a singular a practice, meditation, for 20 years, more or less, and studying, let's say, from the Vedantic perspective, that complement of intellectual understanding, complementing the direct experience through meditation, that's a beautiful mix. That they really, really help each other out. Right. So that was although that was my sort of singular path. Later on into that path, the last sort of few years of that, those years of practice, I became very varied, very eclectic in the teachings and pointings and traditions that I was exposing myself to.
Yeah.
And that was really good for me, because I would be looking at all these different things and tuning into what the common, they're all so different, and yet they're all coming from the same thing. So it was helping me to identify not what the common expression was almost, but what was the common reality.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
because it points to the fact that there isn't a common expression
right.
on the surface level of things,
yeah.
Which in itself is a beautiful teaching.
That's why I throw all sorts of things at it. You know, like I'll quote from here, I'll speak from there, but all the time it's about direct experience and
mm-hmm.
pointing from that. But but I've seen some doesn't work for them.
Yeah, you know, it gets too confusing in the mind. Yeah,
the mind, exactly. I guess by the time I was getting quite eclectic and more varied, very broadly so, by the time I got to that, I was already quite well grounded in my own experience of the light, consciousness as my own being, that it didn't throw me off, and in fact it served me.
Yeah, I think that's probably the really important point there is, you know, if you're exposed to lots of teachers and teachings without the direct experiential grounding in who and what you are,
yeah.
even if it's fleetingly experiential,
yeah.
and certainly there in the intellectual understanding, but it's not maybe an abiding direct
yeah.
experience, but it's enough of a grounding that
you need some kind of introduction to your own consciousness nature from which to work from, I think. I mean, and a lot of it sometimes, you know, you're working with someone, let's say in satsang, and you know, you're trying to get them to that point them to that, so at least they go, oh, okay. And that becomes then, you know, the lamp that's been lit, even though it gets covered, seemingly covered up and lost and whatever, somehow that sense, that first introduction, that first sense,
becomes a compass point.
Becomes there.
So I think that's where I see where there's a lot of confusion in terms of being exposed to different ideas, because sometimes they are vastly paradoxical. You can be exposed to one teacher or teaching talking about something which is seemingly the antithesis of what another teacher or teaching is saying. And so it can become very disorientating if you're looking at teachers or teachings on the surface level of them. I mean, even sometimes I see myself contradicting myself, you know, in things I'm saying. But it's like the way I see it is a lot of this pointing is like pointing to different facets or sides of an infinitely faceted gem.
Yeah, it's the elephant, isn't it? Where you're gem.
And so I think that's where it becomes really important to have the grounding of what is being pointed to beneath and prior to all relative pointings.
And I think it's important to point out that you take any teacher, but Ramana Maharshi comes to mind, and you can work your way through Ramana Maharshi's body of work and expression and find just a tremendous amount of contradictions in there, apparently. And this is what I've noticed in my own work, that the teaching is individual, ultimately, and that a lot of the expressions that you, I, or whoever might make are typically typical to that person at that stage in their awakening.
It's a response.
There are kind of, yes, exactly. There are universal, let's say broadly universal applicable teachings. But you could, someone who's, you know, further along, an appropriate teaching would be different to someone who's not so far along.
Yeah.
And has to, you know, process some stuff, learn how to, you know, handle their own... What's the right word here? I think of things like how, in terms of meditation, for example, there's a sort of a scale of subtlety that is appropriate to be applied as seekers go along. And then we've talked about this before, like that if someone's just coming to meditation for the first time, let's say Ramana did this, you might give them a mantra to work with, because the mind is so busy, so full, that you can't they can't appreciate and recognize the goal, which is the consciousness as the source. You can't point to it. The mind's too busy. So the best thing you can do to start with is give an object to focus on. We have talked to you before, but so you start off maybe like a mantra, and then later on it might be the breath, and then later on it might be the presence itself, and then later on it becomes quite clear. It's just the consciousness itself becomes
resting as
intuitively resting as awareness. So, but you know, the different traditions are quite clear on this. You figure out what's somewhere someone's at, and you give them the right, method and for where they're at.
And I think beyond the different methods that are appropriate for where someone is at, I think the theme running underneath all of that is the ability to fall in love with your practice, and to not see it as homework or the booby prize of,
or
like
something you got to hold your head to the grindstone.
And actually just find a way that practice is very charming and desirable to engage in. And I think for me, effort is where it gets tricky. The sort of a sense of trying, a sense of
holding,
fighting with life. And I think people sometimes think that's sort of the goal of meditation is
wrestle
with your thoughts.
Yes.
And it might be an indicator to me that you maybe not got the right meditation. Like you were talking about appropriateness of different techniques of meditation. Mm-hmm. If there's a sense of wrestling there, it might be
forcing.
It might be that there's an adjustment that's needed in terms of the focal point of the meditation.
Yeah.
Like for instance, a mantra or the breath, or maybe it's too subtle. And actually, it needs to come back to a more obvious object of attention there.
Yeah.
Or something. I don't want to sort of name what that might
be.
Yeah,
but it's individual, isn't it? But it is, you know, it's on a sort of a scale from gross to subtle.
Yeah. Yeah. And so if there's a lot of effort there, a lot of sort of trying, let's say.
Yeah. But even that, even though we're talking about meditation, objects of meditation, let's say. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many different approaches to meditation, but, you know, using an object, and what I mean,
not a physical object necessarily.
A mental object.
Yeah.
Like a sound or the breath, whatever. Or even the subtle sense of self, a subtle sense of being that the mm-hmm. I am is still a subtle object. So even though that... That goes from kind of gross to subtle, and in the end, you know, you talk about in Dzogchen, they're like everything's already perfect. So the discovery of their meditation quotes isn't even meditation at the highest level. It's just letting it all be.
Yeah.
But if you've got a mind full of squirrels, then that's not going to work. Focus, get used to it. But even that sort of taking your point about adjusting the meditation, sometimes even with varying degrees of objects, it still should be an effortless practice. Because if the mind goes off, so your given point of focus, say, or you know, your anchor, your object is say a mantra. When you realize you're not, you just innocently, gently, and without recrimination, return to the mantra. Notice and return.
Yeah.
There's no fight in it. The moment you notice, you come back, even if you go off straight again.
And what I notice with people is there's a poor distinction between effort and persistence. Yeah. And so people, and I've had so many conversations about this over the years, actually, where people report to me that there's effort in their experience.
Yeah.
There's struggle. There's sort of, it feels heavy and effortful and stuff like that. And actually, when we dig down into it, what we discover is not effort. They're annoyed at the persistence that is required.
Right.
So the notice and return, notice and return, notice and return.
Notice and release, notice and release.
Yeah, whatever that might be. But it is persistent, as in it's not a one trip it's not a one shot deal, rather, like one and done.
Yeah.
And so they're equating that repetition and the annoyance at that repetition, which is about expectations.
Yeah.
They're equating that with effort.
Yeah.
And actually, when you point that out, it's like, oh yeah, it's not, this isn't hard work.
Which is solving the problem you were talking about, solving the problem of this impatience and this expectation by actually falling in love with the practice.
Exactly.
Find that point, just really come to enjoy, like Father Thomas Keating famously said in regard to, he had just taught a non-centering prayer. And basically the method of centering prayer is one sits in abidance, use a word once, just to inform yourself and God that you're here for the work, sit in that. And when the mind goes off and you notice it, you simply return back to this a non-grasping space. And so he had just taught a nun, and after her first 20-minute practice, she said, oh, my mind was just so busy, blah, blah, blah. You know, I was just terrible, just couldn't, kept going off. 10,000 times. He said, oh, how wonderful, 10,000 opportunities to return to God.
Yeah.
And that's the sentiment.
Yeah.
Whether it's God, or you conceive it, or the self, or the bliss of being, or the peace and of the silence, whatever. Find that love for that.
Yeah.
And, oh, you come back, how beautiful. Oh, you come back, how beautiful. And so you're not fighting yourself and blaming yourself for inevitably going off in a thought somewhere. Mm-hmm. You just, because you can't not go off on a thought if you haven't noticed you've gone off on a thought.
Yeah.
Got hooked, as Pema Chodron would say, you know, Shenpa, you've been hooked in a stream of thought. You don't know if you're in it, if it's something that's kind of unconscious. And then suddenly you go, oh, here I am. Okay, back to the,
yeah,
back to the quietness, back to the now, back to the whatever your
home,
whatever your home, the self. But it's a release or a return.
Yeah. And it's no effort.
And there's no recrimination. There's no effort.
Yeah, there's no effort to return back to the recognition of the self, that sense of beingness, that sense of existence, that sense of God, whatever word is,
resonates with you as a pointing, yeah.
There's no effort to return the attention there, because actually, it is there by which all of life is known. Mm. We are or always that. It's just the attention focuses away from the subjective experience into the objective experience. And this is where we get lost in thought, the objective experience of thought. And so the return to the subjective experience, the return to the self, is very natural. It's no effort. It's just you may pop right back into the objective immediately, and then so there's where the feeling of annoyance and expectation, attachment to how your practice should be going, and all of this sort of stuff. But yeah, if you can kind of come back to the recognition of the joy of coming home, and enjoy that process, then not see it as a failure of something, but actually just that this is the process of the return, and actually eventually there is never a sense of return or not return. You are abiding, you are living from that space, and any appearance of the objective within that is just an undulation of the self experiencing itself in that objective form temporarily. But it's both, and it's not either or.
Right. I wonder whether, well, I know, I don't wonder at all. So much of that effort and that struggle that people have is with a practice like meditation, for example, is to do with, as you said, expectations.
Yeah.
That, and one of the key expectations is the expectation that the mind can be stilled by force.
Yeah.
It can't. And all you can do is train in the most gentle way. I notice when the mind has got, my attention's caught up in the mind, the point at which you notice. But if the expectation is I should be able to fix my attention through force of will to
silence.
This
is why it's like,
so it's managing, sorry, just yeah. say it's actually, this is why so much of this path, and this is why instruction and teachings and teachers are actually really helpful, to go, look, you need to just tweak that a little bit, because your expectation there is the bit that's throwing you. Change your expectations, introduce them experientially to that gentle notice and return and that gentle abidance, and manage their expectations about, you're not gonna, there might come a time where you rest there, as you say, for long periods of time. And then eventually that will yield to actual total abidance, and whether thoughts come and go then are not an issue.
Well, this is what I was about to say. But is
handling those expectations.
Thoughts are not the issue, and they're not the goal of meditation. The goal of meditation is not to get rid of thoughts.
No.
It is a temporary, can be a temporary goal to reveal the underlying substrate of self.
Yeah.
So temporarily meditation can encourage a quietening of the mind to reveal the substrate. But the goal of meditation is not about getting rid of the mind.
No, no.
Because the thoughts are a functional experience of life, a wonderful experience of life. Why would we reject and deny the experience of thought? But like, so meditation, the goal is not getting rid of thought. It is a temporary quietening of the mind to reveal the substrate. But when that substrate is known, that ground of being is known, the self, the thoughts can be there. Thoughts cannot be there.
Yeah. So, returning to the silence is... I remember... didn't finish that sentence. Apologize. I remember back when, I think it was Ayrton Senna, who was a great famous Brazilian racing driver, Formula One guy, and he died, unfortunately, sadly. He was a great, great racer. And but I don't know whether it was him or someone else was talking about when you come around a tight corner, like super fast, you know, a couple hundred miles an hour, these guys in these cars, and you're swerving off to, you know, you're driving off to the left, and to your right there is a wall and these big, you know, things full of tires and whatever. And he says what's deadly is as you're taking that corner that your attention goes to that wall rather than the road that you're aiming to go on. And so it's where your attention is and where you look, where your attention goes, that's where you follow. That's that follow that. So focus not on where you don't want to be, but focus on where you do want to be. So instead of focusing on getting rid of thoughts, you simply actually bring your attention to the silence. And the thoughts take care of themselves, you know. They may, you're not noticing them. They're not the issue. The issue isn't the thoughts. It's that you're not conditioned to, to appreciate the silence.
Yeah.
So put your attention there. So as long as you're thinking about thoughts, you're just going to be full of thoughts.
Exactly.
Just bring yourself back to your own silent interior. Find that gap. Yeah. Find that silence, that moment of silence.
Can I share a quote that I wrote yesterday? Cultivate a continuous awareness of the ground of self. In light of this dawning clarity, all other considerations and questions will find their natural resolution.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, I'm not directly talking about thoughts there, but considerations and questions is talking about thoughts. And it's that, it's like cultivate your attentiveness towards the ground of self.
Yeah.
And all other considerations, all thoughts, all whatever, will find their natural resolution. Will find their
exactly. Home. You'll see that there's nothing to do about them. Actually, no need. They just once the ground is established as self. Everything, you know, the thoughts come and go. Sensations come and go. Also, desires come and go.
So attune your attentiveness towards the ground.
Source of those things, actually, the ground of those things, as you're saying.
And, you know, because, and it's not wrong, but there can be a time where we're firefighting with thoughts, feelings, emotions. And like I said, it's not wrong. There is definitely a place for that.
Doesn't it? As a function.
But, if we're only forever focused on that aspect, it is forever managing and firefighting that level of existence.
It's like being a traffic cop to thoughts and feelings and stuff.
And it's endless. It is endless. It is unending because that's the nature of that dimension or that level of life. And so there is room for that. There is a necessity for some of that. But you have to attune to a deeper ground And in that depth, it gives context for this management.
Well, we see that from that perspective, it's all just happening.
Mm-hmm. There's the perspective I was talking
about. There's a really, it's kind of blunt in some ways. And you have to, I found the need to sort of handhold seekers to a point at which that even becomes an acceptable statement.
Yeah.
Which becomes then an observation. And this is where in the realm of teaching, let's say, or satsang or whatever, there are, as the Buddhists call it, expedient means, which is to say, which is what we were talking earlier about methodology, is that you point to the person's capacity to recognize and understand. And it's not always, life is consciousness, everything's happening, you are completely powerless and you don't exist as a person. That, right? Too much. But someone could be sincerely, genuinely engaged on the spiritual path towards that kind of recognition. Yeah. But where they are, you can't speak that. You can't. You might hint at it, but it's like the powerlessness I see when I hear certain non-dual teachers speaking in this completely uncompromising way. There's no one here. There's nothing you can do. None of this is happening, all that.
And while
not untrue, it's a blunt instrument and it's not for everyone. No. And because
don't see yourself as consciousness, that if you see yourself as a person, that is incredibly disempowering and frustrating to hear that, those kind of teachings.
And I get it. But, and it's not true, but also teaching, here's the thing, because no one's doing it, and because it's just happening and all that, teaching happens, and appropriate teaching happens. I love this, in the Buddhist tradition, they talk about expedient means and talk about, skillful means, about appropriately teaching to the level that of the person in front of one. And that's a function of reality, of the awakening principle that's part of the ground. The ground of consciousness, of being, the Buddha nature, is always, always teaching, showing, to return the sentient being back to its true nature. And it'll use whatever means is necessary to orchestrate that. And sometimes it's not super direct, non-dual teachings or something like that. Sometimes it's something much more subtle. Mm-hmm. Life itself is Buddha nature gathering, the lost back into its own nature. So that which you seek is seeking you. That's the idea. So yeah, I haven't got much stock for just throwing out a sort of an absolute, uncompromising teaching out. But many people have done it. I mean, Nisargadatta, he did it to some degree. Ramesh Balsekar was a big fan of, there's nothing you can do, was just basically his, incredible message. And it's true, but that was his point. That was his key pointing.
But again, we're talking about different practices, different methods of meditation. Yeah.
Which is itself is expedient.
Yeah, it speaks to that same principle, actually, of like a certain practice is appropriate for where you're at.
That's that's a provisional teaching.
Yeah, certain teachings are appropriate for where you're at. And it's not to say anything is lesser or greater. And this is, I think, where people get sort of hung up on is it sort of gets into a sort of an ego trip here,
yeah,
of like, oh, I've got a higher meditation than this person. Yeah. I've got a, you know.
Oh, I want a higher.
And actually it's
and it's not appropriate.
No, and it's just the recognition of this is how life is playing out. We are all exactly perfectly where we need to be. The meditation practice that resonates, the teaching that resonates is entirely perfect for where we're at.
For growth, for deepening.
And it's not lesser or higher or more or any of those ideas. We've talked about this on the podcast even, and we've extensively talked about this between you and I, of comparison, you know, comparison being, you know, absolutely deadly on the spiritual path. I mean, generally pretty deadly, but particularly on the spiritual path, because it assumes that where you're at is incorrect for or better than another or worse than, you know, all of that. And instead, for me, it's seems very blatantly obvious that we are all resonating and hearing and practicing that which is entirely correct for where we're at, and to really sink into that and trust that, and to not look to others with the assumption that where they're at is better or worse than where you are.
Absolutely. It's that Gita, another Bhagavad Gita verse. Live your own dharma. To practice the dharma of another is dangerous. Better to die in one's own dharma than live the dharma of another.
I think that did come up in one podcast. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's super, super important. You go your own way in your own style. Don't compare. It's so profound, actually, don't compare. Just stay in your own... You know, what's that other quote I really liked? Don't compare yourself to someone else. Compare yourself to who you were yesterday or something like that. And I like, so it, we talk about the metaphor in terms of playing games, and we've talked about this. This idea of golf versus tennis. So if you're playing tennis... and you're hitting the ball over, and then they're hitting the ball back and hitting the ball over. You're literally competing with another person. So, and the game is to win by, you know, beating the other person. It's a very direct form of competition. Mm-hmm. Same with lots of games. But something like golf is a different proposition. Although you are nominally competing with people, ultimately you are so directly competing with yourself. It's like you're not waiting for someone to return a ball. It's all on you. You've just got to keep hitting your best strokes, doing that until you get there, and it keeps you focused. And I think the moment you start to pay too much attention to another and come out of your own self-referral approach, you'll lose it. Again, it's like, you know, like the racing driver looking at the wall. Don't look at the wall. Just keep your attention on the road ahead. That's it. And what's yours? What's your road? What's your lane? What's your...
Yeah.
What's your next?
That speaks to me about the sort of the attitude necessary.
Yeah,
that's for sort of true recognition and insight, or what some would call spiritual awakening.
Yeah.
And again, it's not an attitude of attainment per se, like a mastery, you know, a sense of gaining something. Yeah. It's not that kind of attitude. If anything, it's an attitude of opening and deepening, and pursuing.
Yeah.
As you said, the sort of the truth.
And I think another aspect of that is actually a willingness to sacrifice.
Yeah.
Particularly old views, cherished ideas, when you realize and recognize they've outlived their usefulness, the willingness to let go of those then.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, coming into awakening is a shedding. Of layers of poor conditioning.
Yeah. It's a disruptive process. I've said this before, yeah. And I really see the truth of that sort of viewpoint of awakening as a destructive process. And of course, to a person, there's a fear of being destroyed.
Yeah.
But it is not, it's not that at all. It's a destruction of all that you are not.
Yeah.
To a reveal all that you are.
Of the barriers and the veils, yeah. And the things that stand between, yeah. You and your own.
So it doesn't destroy any, it doesn't destroy anything that you would, no. That you can't do without, put it that way.
Well, I see this, I mean, on a more human level, and I think this is why life's vicissitudes actually can be really powerful catalyst for awakening. You see, you could be going through life with a very strong egoic identity. You know, you could be, I don't know, successful, rich, you know, all this stuff. You know, got all the things, living the high life, healthy, wealthy, and full of, you know, full of pleasures. And then one day something will happen, life happens, and I don't know, you could lose your, some terrible, your company will collapse, or you'll lose your job, or a loved one will die, or something, something, you know, catastrophic. But particularly as it relates to an identity about who and what you are,
yeah.
That's built up around it. Can be a terribly destructive thing. Say, you know, you've got, you're a high flying business person. You're doing, you know, or you know, executive or something, and then one day you're sacked ignominiously and it's over, and you, all your identity was wrapped up in that. But what gets discovered is that, and it can, I mean, it can be really, really terribly destructive, but if you're fortunate, you'll get to a point where you go, oh, all this stuff that I thought I was is now gone, and yet I'm still here. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a version of that. You know, awakenings come in waves. Awakenings come in,
yeah.
You know, big insights that are often forced upon us through life, causing us to see what we're not.
Yeah, I remember when we met, I was working for the company that we both worked for, yeah. Actually, and I worked there basically out of school. And I worked there for, 10 years in the end? I can't remember. Yeah.
Was it that much? Yeah, okay.
Might be. Anyway, 8, 9, 10, something like that. Yeah. Remember, somewhere in there. And I remember that coming to an end. And I didn't realize how much of my identity was wrapped up in that job. It didn't mean to be. That job didn't particularly mean anything greatly to me.
Yeah.
But so much of who and what I thought I was inadvertently had got wrapped up with this role,
yeah.
That I was performing in this job for so long. But I think because I was so young when I started there. Yeah,
you didn't know anything different,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah. And it had come off the back of quite a bit of a mental health crisis in my teenage years. So I remember finishing with that job and having this sort of crisis of identity, which turned out to be a really great thing in the end. And,
yeah.
And really...
It took a minute, though.
It did. It really changed the direction of my life, I would say, that particular end. But I remember for a few months there, right after the end, and, you know, I'd had a redundancy payoff from them, so I didn't have to... You know, jump into something else, yeah, which was a blessing, yeah, really, yeah. Because, but initially I remember being really thrown by it, like really, because I'd been spent all of my life being quite busy, quite, you know, yeah. Very much doing. And then all of a sudden I had all this time on my hands and I didn't handle it very well to start with, I remember. I think I did jump into something busy straight away, but that didn't last.
Well, they say that, like on the big five psychological scale, if you're high in conscientiousness, which you are higher than I am, and people who are high in conscientiousness tend to not do well with unemployment, not being busy. Whereas people who are low, it's hard to get them out, you know, going, but they handle unstructured time and they handle it better. So it's the swings both ways.
Well,
so
my conscientiousness must be...
It was higher. It
must be lower now then.
Well, you're probably...
I'm quite comfortable with...
Yeah, you've settled somewhere in the middle, I think, which is about as it should be.
But the point, I guess, I'm trying to make is... we can have our identities wrapped up in something without even realizing it is.
Yeah.
And when that thing is stripped away unceremoniously often, it can be very disorientating without, like, because reason why I bring up this example, because this job, I didn't particularly love it or even like it in many ways. It wasn't like the great love of my life being stripped away and I'm now grieving, you know, this role that I dreamed of having. No, this was a very mundane job and I didn't even realize how much identity was in there.
Yeah.
And so I guess we got onto this topic because of the destructive nature of awakening and the stripping away of identities. They're not true identities. Yeah. They're not who you are.
And it's the willing. So what's where problem comes in with this stuff, you know, from these kind of examples, which are more relative, you know, awakenings. Oh, well, if I'm not that, what am I then? And maybe you'll restructure a new identity. But which most people do with some identity, but then you go deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole, which most don't. But it's the willingness to sacrifice that which hasn't served you, right? A layer when identified, oh, this isn't, you know, to let that go. The difference between, I know, say, in your case, you struggled with, who am I, what am I going to do, whatever. But it's a bit like the stages of grief, you know. You get to a point where acceptance, you know, you go through, you know, when you lose something, and often identity is part of this, you lose, you know, some activity or some object or something that, you know, provides some identity, ego. You know, if you're trying terribly hard to hold on to that when it's being taken away, when life is saying, nope, not for you anymore, and it's gone, and then, you know, what is it, anger, denial, bargaining, can't remember all of them, but finally grief, but you finally get to acceptance. Okay. And that's the thing, is the willingness to let go for what was but is not meant to be anymore, has been taken away. But if you try to follow that down the drain, you're just going to drown.
To learn how to gracefully let go of that which wasn't meant for you or isn't meant for you is a really powerful lesson for us all.
And so awakening, whether it's sudden or progressive, is about...
gracefully letting go.
Yeah, all the way. All the way, all the possible identities, just letting them fall away. Yeah.
And that's what's meant by the destructive process.
Yeah.
It's not destructive to who and what you fundamentally are.
Yeah.
It's not at all.
It's revealing to that.
And so, because I get a lot of people who, and rightly so, there is this fear around awakening that comes up that I'm going to be destroyed. I'm going to be non-functional as a person. You know, all of these kinds of ideas. And I guess I want to offer some context, and what I feel we're doing here right now is offering some context to what is meant by awakening being a destructive process. It's not that you won't function, it's not that you will cease to be. It is that you'll cease to be that which never truly you were in the first place. And that's what's the part, that's what's
in discovering who you actually are.
And that's why it's called liberation. What is liberated, who and what you truly are, is liberated. And that, on a surface level, often looks like feeling more at home in your skin and more living into the expression of the individual person. And actually those sort of overlays of shoulds and conditioning that has you feel small in your expression is what is destroyed.
Yeah, your limitations, your self, your conceptual limitations in regard to self-identity.
And so this is why it feels liberating. It does, actually. Yeah. I would say it can take some time to really feel that, because the focus first and foremost can be on the destruction of who and what you thought you were. So it can take some time for that real sense of liberation to sort of kick in. After that destructive process has sort of softened and quietened down.
I think, you know, you have to, there is a process, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of the kind of bullying teachings that just want to break you through into awakening without really laying out the foundational thinning of let's say mental density, so the purification of our conceptions and the energetic things that embodied, go along with it. You know, it can happen. People break into, you know, full awakening very rapidly, but it can absolutely destroy someone's life for a period. It's not, you know, it doesn't come without. Sometimes it can be quite destructive, and arguably that's correct for that person. Difficult as that is. But I wouldn't want to go and culture that as right. You need to just bang, wake yourself up. No. I really feel grateful in many ways that my path was as it was, that I had, you know, a couple of decades of regular integrating exposure through practice to my own, you know, my own silent being. You know, it has had an effect on who my body and mind, my energetics. So when awakening did come as a natural thing, it wasn't like, although it wasn't, you know, sweetness and light 100%, but I didn't suffer it too terribly, because of all those years of practice. And I see some people who come to it straight from regular life, you know, they're there, and then one day, bang, something, an awakening can come. So that can be really, really challenging. But then you have to do the work post-awakening. All right, the work you should have laid down before, let's do this now. Let's help with integration. Let's help with embodiment. Let's help with, you know, trauma release and whatnot.
Yeah, I think there's some modern day teachings that discourage, whether they mean to or not, but they do discourage things like practice.
Yeah.
And I think that I get why they do that, because they're trying to directly point to that which is already there.
Yeah.
That here, rather.
Yeah.
But I think there is a slight disservice in, or rather a neglect of the other benefits of regular practice.
Yeah.
That is not just about that it's not a direct pointing, so therefore we discard it.
Well, often it's a bypass, isn't it? I mean, I come across people who were like, they don't want to do the practice. They just want the awakening, and they're not ready for it.
Well, it's very now, which is the culture right now. So exactly. It's very evocative.
And they just want to bypass. And again, we're talking about you have to actually fall in love. Mm-hmm. You know, well, Dogen Zenji, great Buddhist exponent, master, he was really about meditation. And his famous viewpoint was meditation is enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So if you want to bypass something like, and I'm not saying everyone has to go this way, but if you want to bypass like a spiritual practice to get to the awakening, you're missing the point. The very being that you are, that you're hoping to embody and realize in awakening, is the very one you're being exposed to every time you get on the cushion.
Yeah.
So don't bypass your misguidings. Don't be lazy. Yeah. I would say that, not that the meditation is the causal agent. This is where it gets tricky.
Yes, it does.
Right? Where you say, well, if I meditate, that's the cause that leads me to awakening. No, it's not. It's more like the symptom of the fact that you are approaching it. But it's certainly, if you're on the thing and you're avoiding any kind of approach that would drop you into your heart, into yourself, because you have an idea about what awakening looks like,
yep.
Then that's a sign and a symptom of something that needs to adjust as well.
Yep.
If you're going to get what you, but find it now. Yeah. There is.
Awakening is an act of grace. It's not something we bring about, but meditation practice is sort of a symptom of that grace taking hold, and it certainly makes one more aware of the possibility of that grace.
So, you know, it's an interesting conundrum to talk about doing and non-doing mm-hmm. in the same breath. Mm-hmm. And we have a friend who, again, works with spiritual transmission. And my sense of it is that nominally on a relative level, yes, there's a transmission, right? The intention of the transmitter is aiming at to, you know, activate, let's say, or transmit something. So this seems to be, you're acting out like a causal relationship.
Yeah.
But we know, no, this is just how this is playing out.
Yeah.
And so you have to hold those two ideas. You still do it. Just because it's non-doing at the end of it doesn't mean that that doing doesn't still happen.
Yeah.
But I liked the analogy he used to describe it about receiving these transmissions to people who were coming to with him. And it was the analogy of awakening's a bit like lightning striking, right? It's an act of God in some sense. It's an act of grace. It comes when it's ready to come. But if you're inclined and you climb a mountain in a thunderstorm, the chances of getting hit by lightning are much higher. And of course, to translate that into even more non-dual, the fact that you find yourself climbing the mountain in a thunderstorm kind of shows you that you're approaching awakening.
Yeah, I love that. And it actually reminds me of another friend of ours who's a spiritual teacher. They said something one day, which I read, that they shared, and saying enlightenment is an accident, but spiritual practice makes one accident prone.
Brilliant.
Exactly. It's the same sort of thing.
Yeah. So although both of us in our writing and teaching point extensively to non-doership, because it is fundamental and it's real and true, and that's the final nature of it, of reality. We meet whoever is seeking where they are and lead a path of pointing towards that reality to be discovered, ideally. But like Ramana Maharshi used to talk about, someone said, how long should I do self-inquiry? You know, who am I? How long should I do self-inquiry? And Ramana said, as long as there's someone who's doing it.
Exactly.
And he would talk about the process, this practice of self-inquiry, as like a stick on a funeral pyre. You know, you have the big fire going there and you'd keep poking the stick in there to move the coals to make sure it burnt away. And as you're doing that, the stick's getting burnt away. So as you're doing your self-inquiry, you're destroying the one who's asking the question. But you can't bypass it. You have to go. The process is that, you know, do the practice meditation, until there's no one left to be practicing.
Exactly. Yeah.
But to sit there in your own mind and go, there's no one here, there's nothing to do. And that's just coming from mind, not from recognition.
That's the bypass.
That's the bypass, yeah.
Yeah. And while not untrue in if there is a direct recognition,
sure,
if it is just coming from the mind, and who and you do believe yourself to be a doer, even though intellectually you're not, this is where the inquiry of, well, who and what am I talking about when I say I am the doer, when I say.
Yeah, it's that. A recognition. So we talk about that word we use a lot, recognition, recognition, realization. It's, you recognize what's already true. But until you do, don't let the mind fool that, oh, because I understand in my mind that there's no doer. Because I had that for years. I mean, I was, this whole no free will thing.
Oh, yeah, you've been talking about that for
as long as I can remember. Yeah. And, you know, gone into
talks. But it doesn't mean that that was your direct experience. You intellectually understood it, and there was a sense of what, experientially, there was a sense of it.
Yeah, all sorts of angles. I couldn't find the doer, but somehow I was still in here with a sense of myself as a doer.
Yeah.
Even though my mind was pretty clear on, and my observations and what reality was, this is just happening and there's no doer. Yeah. But there was something else that I hadn't fully
uprooted.
And recognized fully my own essential being.
Yeah.
As consciousness, the non-doer. So that's, yeah.
Yeah. So while there is still that, there's work to be done.
There's work to be done. And don't worry about it. Don't think that, you know, you're kind of falling into some, well, they tell me I'm a non-doer, so I shouldn't be doing meditation. And that's it, right? That's what some of the non-dualists, they're like, well, because the teaching, this is what we were talking about earlier, you know, because the teaching, quotes, is telling them the answers before they discover, they're not, and they're taking them out of context. They're taking them as an understanding to be remembered and to be repeated or something.
Exactly. They're taking it as truth rather than discovering the truth in their own experience. Exactly. And so you can't skip that. You can't skip that self-discovery part of it. You can't just learn what you intellectually understand to be true. You have to actually discover it. It's like, I think the thing that comes to mind right now is this sense of, like, when I come into contact with someone who does have a very beautiful intellectual understanding of something, but there is a disconnect between their own direct experience and their intellectual understanding, and there's a frustration there, obviously, because they get what is being spoken of, but they don't
realize what
is being spoken of. And so for me,
it can be a trap. It can be a real hindrance.
It can be a very, very frustrating trap. And I've met many people who fall into that. And what comes to mind in where I've gone with people with this is, and often they're reluctant to go there because they feel they know what I'm speaking of. And it's like the words that come is slow right down. Get right back into, instead of skipping over what you know to be true, in each and every moment, slow right down and confirm in your own recognition where there is truth or untruth to what is being said. Don't shy away from where you see a disconnect between what you know to be true and what your experience is, because there is where you're going to discover where you have some unmet assumptions that need to be unpacked and seen through. Some clarity needs to come into those spaces. Yeah. So slowing down allows you to not skip the steps into the intellect and actually allows you to come into a rightful relationship with your own experience, rather than just your intellectual understanding. So it is often a factor of slowing down.
Well, it's funny. I have an analogy just sort of came to mind, which is you're at a river and it's full of stepping stones, and you spend your life going from stepping stone to stepping stone, stepping stone, bouncing around all this, the surface of this river, stone to stone to stone to stone to stone, and go, where's the water? But you keep skipping over, you keep landing on the stones, which is the mind, landing on these objects of mind, and you're missing that the water is everywhere. Mm-hmm. But you, and so we do it with thinking. This is why breaking the mind stream is so important. Getting the gap, identifying that for most people who just know nothing but these stepping stones and can't see water for the life of them, actually that introduction to go stop. As you say, slow down.
Slow right down.
Now look down.
Pay attention.
And there it is, the water. The, and so once that thought's done, before the next one comes up, just what's present.
Yeah.
And that introduction to the what we are. The awareness nature, the non-conceptual living awareness nature.
Can I share something that came out in a session last week, I think it was, and it's not that I haven't said this in a million different ways before, but it came out in a very succinct three-step sort of method. I don't know. I don't like calling it that, but this one could call it that. And it just seems like a very simple way for someone to recognize the water, put it that way. So it was the first step is to identify that sense of existence, that sense of beingness. The next step, notice that existence, that beingness, is aware of objects of perception. And the third step, recognize that I am that, i.e. the subjectivity of that beingness, that awareness.
Nice.
Just really simple.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's why I love this simple introduction, right? It's so simple. It's so present. If you slow down, follow the pointing, recognize that simple thing. And that then becomes the first crack. Because, of course, life goes on, that's forgotten about, but one will return to that. Okay, I need to come back to that, And then, you know, get on with life and you feel like you're out of it and it's like one or the other. Mm-hmm. But the more and more one sits in that, dwells as that, follows that instruction into the silence of their own being, sooner or later that recognition is with you more and more, and finally it just stays. It becomes the background has become the foreground, so to speak. And everything is experienced from within that as a modulation of that. And so there's a progressive path through that, and it starts with this simple, find that simple. Yes, we've been talking a lot about practices today, and you know, that's a beautiful one. That whatever that is, let that be the anchor. Mm-hmm. You know, if that resonates with you, let that be the anchor. Find that quiet spot. Don't worry about it for now, but just find it, inhabit it, sit with it, be it, and fall in love with it. Because it is love itself, and that it is, recognize the charm of that when you're there, actually. When I say there, quotes, but when that's your experience, notice the charm of that, notice the peace of that.
Yeah. And you can't, that charm, that peace has a quietness to it, that's why this sort of slowing down into the present moment is really important, because that's where you'll find that quiet, calm, that quiet peace, that charm of life is found in this present moment. And it's easily missed through the loudness of the intellectual mind skipping over and thinking it knows what is being spoken of.
Yeah. And of course, this is what occurs to me is that, you know, this is one approach. This is an approach. Yeah, yeah. You know, another approach is let it be. Let the flow of being move without any obstruction from you. Feel where you are, let it go. Feel, oh, there I am, I can feel my own contraction. Release that. And let life flow. And, you know, that's another approach, is just to notice where you're contracted around something. No, in your present moment. Yeah, and just release it. No, you're grasping with you. Let it go. And in the end, you kind of disappear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so again, that's more of an energetic or somatic approach to revealing and allowing the nature, because in the end, there's no allowing left, because there's no one left who would allow or not allow, because consciousness itself is completely non-restrictive and constricting. Everything flows freely as you. So in releasing these little contractions and large ones, finally, you exist in a state of complete openness. Then you realize a lot of what you took to be you was just a bunch of energetic contractions and a bunch of ideas about who you were.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I absolutely agree with that. I think contractions can be a little tricky though, because contractions can show up when you've realized the ground that you are, that is not contracting, cannot contract.
Yeah.
Within that ground can show up contractions, and yet they're seen as just that in itself, that contraction is to a flow of life. So I think,
but we're talking on two,
exactly,
two levels.
Yes. And so I'm just introducing that well. It's like the releasing of those contractions reveals that ground, but once that ground has been revealed, the recognition of those contractions were always just part of the flow as well.
Right.
And so I get what you're saying. I wanted to add that extra step there, which goes
well.
Beyond.
It's where I guess what we're touching on and talking about is where practice becomes insight.
Yeah.
Right. That we're prescribing a practice of say releasing,
exactly,
or even the practice of noticing,
exactly,
the practice of returning or abiding. Yep. Those are the practices.
Yep.
But ultimately, if you and self-inquiry or whatever, but ultimately, when those practices
reveal
they are followed
and reveal the true nature,
nature becomes consciousness can't truly contract.
Yeah,
and
so then it becomes a description.
It's just it becomes prescription, becomes description. Okay. Shall we wrap it up for today?
Let's do that.
All right, cool. That was nice. Okay, thanks everyone for listening. If you feel you want to subscribe, please do so.
And share.
If you feel you want to share it with someone you think might like it, then we'd be thrilled. Anyway, hope to see you next time. Or hear you, or you'll hear us. Okay, I'm going to cut that out. See you next week.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.